Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMC ortho.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us in the studio today for Medical Monday, we're very lucky to have him, is Dr. Daniel O'Day. He's a board-certified cardiologist and chief of cardiology at Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. He also serves as managing partner of the program at the Heart Center, also in Poughkeepsie. He's the first cardiologist in Dutchess County to be board certified in cardiovascular CT and specializes in treatment and prevention of cardiovascular diseases. Dr. O'Day earned his medical degree at New York Medical College. He completed his internship and residency at University Hospital of Boston University. He also completed a fellowship in cardiovascular diseases at Westchester County Medical Center. He's board certified by the National Board of Medical Examiners and the American Board of Internal Medicine. Dr. O'Day, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you very much, Alan. Pleased to be here.
Well, great to have you back again. The number to call, everybody, is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, so, Doc, what's hot? In other words, how do we stay alive a little bit longer, according to the latest on heart disease?
Well, to stay alive longer, it's pretty much the same old stuff, Alan. Watch your diet, be careful, and exercise. I think exercise is probably the most important thing we can do.
How much exercise?
At least 3 times a week, at least 30 minutes a day.
So if I do an hour on the bike every morning, indoor bike, when it's bad outside, an hour every day, never miss, is that good or bad?
It's good. But it's probably a little bit overkill. After you get to a certain level, there's a law of diminishing returns.
Sure.
You're not going to get a whole lot more out of it. So
sure.
You're probably doing a little bit overkill. It might be good to give your body a rest one day a week, especially if you're getting a little older. But other than that, it's perfect.
Can't do it. and I know that there's just been some new dietary guidelines, which we see. Stay away from sugar and white flour.
Those are pretty important things. And we're coming around now. There's a whole shift in dietary thinking in terms of heart disease. Less importance put on intake of saturated fats and more importance on avoiding things that are more or less sugar and flour, white things, things that are made and that we mill and we create as human beings rather than natural things. So, you know, if you can stay away from anything white,
Yeah, sure.
You're doing pretty good.
Do you have intuitive feelings about these recommendations?
I do. I actually have tried a lot of these things myself.
Me too.
And, I think that I feel better when I avoid things with high sugar and breads and things like that. Even if I end up eating a little bit more meat and poultry, I definitely feel better.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, we'll go to Jim in Matamoras, Pennsylvania. Welcome back to the program, Jim. You're on.
What effects does chronic stress have on the heart, and what conditions is it likely to precipitate?
Thank you very much, Jim. Glad you came on board and asked a question. I'm also glad you drew a distinction between acute and chronic stress. Your question's about chronic stress, and chronic stress can be manifested in multiple ways. Your body reacts to it by making what we call stress hormones. And these stress hormones are generally fairly deleterious and harmful to us. They can lead to the buildup of cholesterol in your body. They can lead to higher levels of adrenaline, noradrenaline. That can raise your blood pressure, create damage to the lining of the blood vessels, which over time can cause heart attacks and strokes. There's also acute stress, however. And I'll give you a little story about acute stress. Most cardiologists can give you a similar story. I had a lady one time came to see me. She was in a parking lot in the area where we live, and she was held up, a stick-up job. And shortly, almost immediately thereafter, started to complain of chest pain. Brought her into the hospital. She had elevated cardiac enzymes in her blood, indicative of a heart attack. And when we went to look and we took pictures of the heart, there was significant damage to the heart, but the arteries themselves were absolutely clear, clean and green. And that is called stress cardiomyopathy. There's another name called Takasago syndrome. It's named after a Japanese guy, and it's very well described and very common. We see this 4, 5, 6 times a year, always associated with some type of acute stress. A dog dying, a family member dying, this person was robbed. So you can see stress can actually pour out hormones into your body that can have very deleterious effects in the short term as well.
And how do you get around that?
Not much you can do about that one. If you are exposed to severe stress and you have severe chest pain like that, you have to come in and see us right away. The good news is that particular syndrome, by far, many of those patients recover. With the right therapy and medications, most of them will get better.
So this is just so fascinating to me because our next person, thank you very much, Jim, is Abigail from Kingston. And Abigail has a related question. Go ahead, Abigail.
Hello, Alan. So good to speak with you. It sounds much like a Law and Order program. I know how much you love that. Anyway.
I can't get enough. Yeah.
The question was concerning what a broken heart, stress, and unhappiness, how does that affect that organ, that heart?
Well, thanks for the question, Abigail. And I'm sure you were listening to Jim's question as well.
No, I wasn't.
Oh, you weren't? Oh, okay.
Well, to recapitulate, Abigail, Jim asked the very same question about stress, and Doc gave some very good examples of how stress can really bring on a heart attack.
So let's talk a little bit about just unhappiness.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of studies have looked at unhappiness. Many people who have heart attacks and also people who have bypass surgery are very prone to go through a period of depression thereafter. Many studies have looked at this, and the people that do manifest depression and are unhappy do worse. They have a worse prognosis. They have more side effects, more arrhythmias, more heart failure, and they don't do as well as people who are happy.
Of course not.
Absolutely. If you're happy, you're going to do a whole lot better. And
you mean there are such things as happy people?
Not very many.
Well, they're not too happy, Alan. Don't get too excited. I mean, really, calm down. But, you know, my mother lived a very sad life, and she had a lot of heart problems. Of course, she smoked also, which was ridiculous. But she was a very unhappy person, and you know, did open heart surgery. There were all kinds of things to supposedly heal her, and probably she would have been better in therapy or something. I don't know. But anyway, thank you for your
question. You're welcome. And you brought up a very good point, and that is that unhappy people turn to unhealthy behaviors.
Well, that's interesting, like smoking.
They drink, they smoke, some do drugs.
I have to ask you a little bit of a question.
Mm-hmm.
What if that unhealthy, in quotes, behavior, such as drinking, such as, not talking about being an alcoholic.
But Abigail, you have to hurry because we're really...
Take it over, Alan.
Okay.
Aviento.
Thanks a lot. Aviento. Okay. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Stent versus total, you know, heart stuff, you know, taking out the vein from the leg and putting it in.
Stent versus bypass surgery.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. That's
right. Yep, that's fine. It depends, and it depends on what your anatomy is and what kind of problems you've had in the past. Mm-hmm. Lots of studies looking at it. If you have an artery that's a single vessel, you have good heart function, you haven't had a big heart attack, generally stents are good, and they take care of the problem, which is chest discomfort or angina. The one thing the stents are not particularly good at least not when they're elective, is making you live longer. No real studies showing that stenting arteries makes you live longer.
And how about the other thing?
Bypass surgery, for sure. If you have bypass surgery and you need it, particularly if it's for multiple vessels, especially the big vessel to the front of your heart called the LAD, or the left main, which is the main vessel, people that have that done do live longer and healthier lives.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive inpatient and outpatient health care in Schenectady and southern Saratoga counties. EllisMedicine.org. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, takeout, delivery, 518-432-0358. Midwives of the Hudson Valley and Capital Region, offering women's health care, maternity care, and home birth services throughout the Hudson Valley and Capital Regions. Midwives support WAMC.com. And Union College Concert Series, presenting the Miro String Quartet, performing works of Haydn, Schubert, and Günther Schuller. Sunday, March 8th at 3 p.m., unioncollegeconcerts.org.
One 800 348 2551. Chances of getting in right now are pretty good. Cholesterol medicines. Anything new, Doc?
Oh, there's plenty new. There's an older medication called Zeti or ezetimibe that just got some favorable press from a study that came out. That study has been going on forever. We've been waiting for that for eight years, that study.
I take it, but there was an earlier study that said, yeah, your numbers go down, but it doesn't stop the number of unsatisfactory results.
Correct. And that's what this trial was for, and this trial was called Improve It, so people can go online and look it up. And what it showed was that when added to a statin, and in this case it was simvastatin or Zocor, that there was a slight reduction in event rates, slight, okay? Certainly was not a blockbuster. Certainly wasn't bad for you, but it was a little bit better. But that's not what we're real excited about. There's a whole new class of compounds that are currently undergoing study. We're doing some of the studies at the Heart Center now called what we call PCSK9 inhibitors. And there's a couple of companies that have one of these drugs. They were featured on the New York Times on the front page a couple of years ago. And these drugs work very interestingly. They make your body have more receptors on the liver cells that grab the cholesterol and pull it out of the body. So the net result of making more of these receptors is less circulating cholesterol throughout the body. And you can get dramatic reductions in cholesterol. LDL cholesterol is usually we aim for under 100, preferably under 70. We're getting LDL cholesterols in the 20, 30, 40 ranges with this drug. Now, what we have to figure out is, does that translate into better outcomes, less heart attacks, strokes, and death, which is what we really want?
And what about the liver itself?
That's the other question is now what about toxicity? And so that's what we're going through the trials with right now, looking at the medications to see if they're actually going to prevent events at an acceptable risk.
Interesting. That's very
Those are very interesting medications.
So when my parents had heart disease back in the day, they always had, you know, they were always sucking something under their tongue. What was that?
Nitroglycerin.
Nitroglycerin, right. Always sucking nitroglycerin under the tongue. Has that changed?
Well, we don't like to see you doing that anymore. When that happens, that means you're actually having the chest discomfort.
Right.
We want to intervene before you're walking around having a lot of chest discomfort. For sure, there are a couple of people that have chronic angina and they have chest discomfort. But I think now we're much better at preventing those episodes. And our goal is to make sure that people can function in their daily lives without any chest discomfort.
Interesting. Okay, we'll go to Edward in Hopewell Junction, right in your neighborhood, Doc.
Hello.
Hopewell Junction. Go ahead.
Hello, doctor.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have atrial fibrillation, persistent atrial fibrillation since March of 07. I've been taking warfarin for it, and that's very effective for the INR. But I'd like to know, how can I get rid of it if I wanted to? It does get me tired occasionally, and I want to know if there's a way, if I've heard of cardiac ablation. Do you do that with someone like me who I can live my daily life without a real problem? But I would love to get rid of it, to get rid of the fatigue that it causes.
Okay, before you answer, Doc, because that's my job here, he mentioned INR. What is that?
That's
No, not you, not you. You're not the doc, him. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay.
That is a measurement of the thickness of the blood. It's called the International Normalized Ratio.
Right.
And a 1 means you're the same thickness as everybody else. Okay. If you're a 2, that means you're twice as thin as everybody else.
Okay. And what these drugs do is it thins your blood. Is that
correct?
Right?
It prevents stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation who are at increased risk of stroke.
Okay. So now we answer his question.
Okay. The short answer is, if you've had it since 2007, you're not coming out of it. Okay. If it's been there that long, there are changes that occur in your heart that make it very difficult for us to get you back into a normal rhythm and keep it there. Now, having said that, if you had told me you had it since March of this year or, you know, some other shorter period of time, there are different ways that you can get the heart back into a normal rhythm. First is with medication. There are certain medications that you can take to do it. None of them are 100% effective. And the second is with a procedure called a atrial fibrillation ablation, otherwise called a pulmonary vein isolation. And that is where we actually go in and make little cuts in the heart using radio frequency energy that isolate the area that it comes from. Again, not 100% effective. If you do it multiple times, you can get up into the 80% effective range. But there is no medication and no procedure that's 100% effective in treating and getting rid of atrial fibrillation.
Is it dangerous when you do these some of the operations?
Well, certainly there is some risk associated with it. The risk associated with an ablation like that is relatively low, but it's not zero. And so you have to weigh that against the risk of the atrial fibrillation itself. So bottom line is we only do it on people who are significantly symptomatic. They feel it and it bothers them in their daily lives.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Edward.
Thank you.
Right, let's go to Melinda in Hillsdale. Okay, Melinda.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Alan.
Sure.
Here, I'm calling about something called SCAD. I think it means sudden coronary artery dissection, and it happened to my daughter, who is 42, and I thought it might be a service to everybody if the doctor could talk about it a little bit and explain it, because from what I've read about it, it has a very high mortality if the young person, who's usually perfectly healthy, doesn't pay attention to the symptoms.
Fortunately, Melinda, it's rare. And that's the good thing. I have a patient who has it, and actually I have a patient who's had it twice.
Really?
It's generally associated with some form of stressful event. It happens sometimes during pregnancy. That's not an unusual time for it to occur.
And what is it, Doc?
It's where the artery that feeds the heart, we were just talking about bypass surgery and stents and putting things into the LAD and the left main and things. It's actually where the artery tears itself. And when it tears itself, you get a true lumen where the blood is supposed to flow, and you get a false lumen where blood is not supposed to be. And that usually impinges on the true lumen and can cause a heart attack.
And you say true lumen?
True lumen is where the normal artery wall itself.
I see.
So it's almost like if you had a couple of layers of paper in your hand, and you poked the pencil through the first layer, but between the first layer and the second layer, the pencil went in there. Yeah. That's where the blood goes. And it's not good. It is dangerous. There are different ways to treat it now. You can, in extreme forms of it, you might need to have bypass surgery. A lot of times now we can put stents in there and plaster the wall up against itself so that it seals itself off and stops. Sometimes these are associated with abnormalities of the blood vessel wall themselves. So you can get a congenital abnormality of the collagen matrix, the stuff that forms the blood vessel wall, that makes it more prone to get this. And sometimes we can make that diagnosis by doing biopsies.
So what do you do as opposed to what the surgeons do?
What we do as cardiologists generally is we put stents into vessels.
Oh, you do?
And we go up through the leg and things like that. Surgeons actually open you up generally. They will, you know, put a 6-7 inch incision in your chest. They'll go in there and they'll take an artery from your chest wall or a vein from your leg and actually go around the damage. What cardiologists generally do is we try to make the artery itself bigger by putting a stent, a metal coil in or a balloon, and reestablishing blood flow that way.
And when we hear about pig valves and other valves that people put in, that's something that a surgeon would do, right?
Generally a surgeon. However, that world is changing now. Particularly for aortic valves, which is the main valve that comes out of your heart, there is something called TAVR, or transcutaneous aortic valve replacement. And with that, what we do is through an artery in the leg, we run a tube up to the heart, and we advance a collapsed valve on a wire to where it needs to get to.
Wow.
And then utilizing a fairly large balloon, we situate that valve where it's supposed to be, inflate the balloon, and basically plaster it up against the wall, and it has hooks on it that grab where it's supposed to go.
And you do that?
I do not do it myself, but cardiologists do it, yes.
But cardiologists do it. I'm feeling a little faint. Hey, Melinda, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Okay, and that leaves one free phone open. Howard of New Paltz. Howard.
Hello, how are you?
We're good. How about you?
I'm doing good. I have a, this is not a challenging kind of question, but I just want to know if you've heard of chelation therapy or disodium dicalcium.
Yes, I have.
Have you researched it at all and any kind of good findings on that?
Actually, we participated in a trial utilizing chelation therapy and high-dose vitamin therapy that was run by the National Institute of Health in the late 1990s and early 2000s. This was another one of those trials that took forever to get done. Somewhat controversial in terms of the outcome of the trial. But what it did show, actually, to a lot of people's surprise, was that the chelation therapy group did do slightly better than the usual care group. High-dose vitamin therapy didn't do anything in that particular trial.
And chelation, one more time, is what?
Chelation is this EDTA solution that he's talking about, and rather long word. Yeah. And what it does is it actually chelates or grabs onto certain metals, heavy metals, and pulls them out of your body. So I would say that the answer is still out. The jury's still out on that one. We don't have enough data to say yes or no on it yet. We still have to do some more trials on it, but the preliminary data is encouraging enough that I think another trial needs to be done.
Not bad. Okay, Howard, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, let's go to Jody. Yeah, Jody in Vernon, New Jersey. Okay, Jody.
Hi, Alan. Nice show. I'm going to be brief. I just wanted to know, is there any correlation between root canal and heart disease?
That's an easy one, not to my knowledge. Okay. I've had a couple of root canals, and I sure hope not.
Yeah, I did too, because I know periodontal disease, they say sometimes it correlates with heart disease.
That's
I've had a few root canals, and I was concerned.
Right. That's certainly true. I would say not getting the root canal would be more dangerous, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
What is associated with heart disease is any type of systemic inflammatory process going on in your body. So if you have rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, periodontal disease, any type of an infection that's kind of sitting there and kind of just being indolent and causing your body to create these inflammatory chemicals in your body, that's not good for you. Mm-hmm. So if you don't get a root canal, you don't clean out an abscess, I would think that that would be worse for
and
you.
And while we're on the subject, is there a test? I thought there was a test you could take for the amount of inflammation in
there's
the body.
There's two tests. Yeah. One is called a SED rate, which is a little bit more crude. And then there's something called a C-reactive protein, and that's probably the one you're thinking of.
And I don't think the insurance companies pay for that one.
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It depends on your insurance company.
Uh-huh.
Generally, if you have Medicare, Medicare will pay for it.
And what does that show?
It shows a degree of inflammation in your body, but it doesn't tell you is where it's coming from.
Right.
So if you have another illness that can cause inflammation, it's not as helpful. But if you don't and you're otherwise reasonably healthy, a high CRP level, meaning the highest 25% of people in the world, in the country, say, that's the same as having a high cholesterol level in terms of risk.
Interesting. Interesting. Jody, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Bye now.
Okay. Let's go to Sandy in Roe, New Jersey. Okay. Sandy, you're on.
Yes. I have a question about LDL levels. Is the particle size important? Is it important to know that?
That's a good question, Sandy. You will find people who passionately argue on both sides of that question. There is a stream of thought that says the small, dense LDL particles, think of them like little BBs, are worse for you than the fluffy, buoyant kind. Studies that have been done so far have failed to really show that in large populations that's entirely true. Now, having said that, might there be a time in the future where we find certain genetic types of people that is more accurate representation for them? Yeah, I think that might be coming along down the pike as we get into what we call personalized or genomic medicine. But for right now, in terms of a big population, we can't recommend that everybody have that checked.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. And we get something on the email at foxpop@wamc.org. Good afternoon, doctor. What does making the heart beat harder through exercise actually help? Why does making the heart beat harder through exercise actually help with high blood pressure? If I have high blood pressure, shouldn't I take it easy instead?
No. Absolutely not. Nice try, though. Actually, the exercise does a whole lot of things for you that are good. The actual pumping of the heart and the heart rate are probably the least important things. The actual using your muscles, getting the blood flow to the muscles, getting the hormones in your body, knock down all the inflammatory hormones, making you feel better. A nod to Melinda, who called earlier, perhaps less unhappiness. Always feel better when you exercise.
I do.
Your body releases natural endorphins, which are opioid-like chemicals that make you feel better. The runner's high. All those things, it's a myriad of things that makes you feel better. It's not necessarily the heart rate. And that's why I tell my patients, sometimes we put people on medications that slow the heart rate. And they may not be able to get their heart rate up to the 150, 160 that people who are exercise gurus recommend. They still benefit greatly from exercise, even though they're not getting their heart rate up, even though they're not getting their blood pressure up.
Is walking as good as running?
Walking is as good as running, yes. As long as you get your heart rate up and move, yeah, it's as good as running.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Okay, now let's go to Chris in Kingston. Chris in Kingston, you're on.
Hi, Doc. My question is more of a preventative nature. How does one really know whether one's heart and circulatory system is in good shape? I mean, I'm a fairly healthy guy, exercise fairly regularly, decent diet, but my annual physical consists of, you know, EKG and some cholesterol numbers, which, you know, are typically pretty good. But how does one really know? I mean, that doesn't seem to be, you know, it doesn't seem to be as definitive as, you know, as it could be.
As we'd all like it to be.
Yeah.
Okay. Chris, how old are you?
I'm 62.
62, okay. So the answer to this question kind of depends a little bit on your age. For most of us, when you go to the doctor, they're going to ask you about a lot of things. They're going to check to see if you have high blood pressure. They're going to see if you have diabetes by doing a blood sugar test on you. They're going to ask you about smoking. They're going to ask you about exercise. They're going to ask you about your family history. All those things are important, and you can ask yourself the same questions and kind of come up with your risk factors as well. The question then becomes, if you have a lot of those things that are yes. So if you have a family history, if your father dropped dead at the age of, you're 62, if he dropped dead at the age of 65, if you have high blood pressure and maybe a couple of other risk factors, maybe your cholesterol isn't optimal. Now your question then becomes a little bit different. Now I've got risk factors. How do I know where my heart stands? And there's a couple of things you can do. One thing is called a calcium score. A calcium score is a mini CAT scan of your chest. And what they're doing with that is they're looking for the buildup of calcium in the arteries. Generally, it's not covered by most insurances. It is covered by some, but it's not expensive. It's less than $100 in most places. Unless you go to New York City, then it's a little bit more expensive there. But in most places.
And you're a specialist, right, Doc, in CT scan?
That's correct. So this is kind of what I do. And with that, we could see how much calcium is deposited in your arteries. And it turns out that degree of calcium deposition gives you a number. And that number we can use to predict what your risk of a heart attack is. And it turns out that number is better than everything else I just mentioned. Presence or absence of high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, family history, exercise. All those things put together, the calcium score is a better predictor at who's going to have a heart attack than all those things put together. So if you want to know, if you really want to know, that's the test I would recommend.
And as long as you're on the subject, how do we determine how to lower our calcium in our bodies?
Okay. Again, this is a little bit different, though, Alan. A calcium score is different than the serum calcium. Serum calcium is very tightly monitored by hormones in your body, hormones in your from glands in your neck called the parathyroid hormones.
Sure.
They talk to your bones. And they say, bones give me more calcium, bones give me less calcium. And so the calcium level is very, very tightly regulated. This calcium score is a whole different kettle of fish and actually goes back to the inflammation we talked about earlier. Mm. Anywhere in your body where there's inflammation on a chronic basis, your body will lay down calcium. Arthritis, tendonitis, bursitis, calcific tendonitis, all those things are big examples of that. But the same thing happens on a microscopic level when cholesterol is deposited in your artery wall. Your body knows it's not supposed to be there. So there's a little inflammatory reaction, and that's fine. And then it happens again and again and again. And you get this repetitive injury, and that repetitive injury causes your body to lay down calcium. We know from autopsy studies that the only place we see the buildup of cholesterol in arteries, the only place we see calcium is where we see the buildup of cholesterol. No cholesterol, no calcium.
Amazing. Well, Chris, you got quite a lecture there. Thank you, Ray. Thanks a lot. All right, let's go to Joanna in South Hadley. Joanna, you got go, and we only have 2 minutes to do this in. Go ahead.
What's your current thinking about low-dose aspirin for the general population, or I guess a little more specifically women over menopause?
The general thinking is if you're very low risk, if you don't have a lot of the risk factors that I just talked about, particularly if you have a negative calcium score, if you have none of the risk factors I talked about, then the risk of the aspirin probably outweighs the benefit.
No, no.
However, if you do have a significant risk, then I still recommend low-dose aspirin.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I've just gotten some bad news. We'll be joining you back in just a moment. Give us your calls.
Support comes from Nathan Littower Hospital, offering new urological treatments with urologist Dr. Paul Husson, NLH.org. Mass Mocha, North Adams, Massachusetts, presents Available Light with choreographer Lucinda Childs, composer John Adams, and set designer Frank Geary, March 6th through 8th, massmocha.org. Subsidium Technologies, serving area businesses and organizations as a single point of contact for custom telecommunications plans with over two decades of industry experience. SubsidiumTech.com. And the UMass Fine Arts Center, presenting ACF Puppets, Taiwanese Glove Puppets, on Sunday with a post-show meet and greet in Bowker Auditorium, FineArtsCenter.com.
And we're back. Thank you, Zachary. Okay, Dr. O'Day is answering your questions. As you know, he's terrific if you've been listening. Let's go to Dee in Poughkeepsie. Okay, Dee, you're on.
Hello.
Hello, Dee, you're on.
Hi, I have a question. If you have an internal jugular vein that is clogged up with a thrombosis, and then you have and you had a stent put in, a week later, is there any relation between that? I mean, did the thrombosis clog up your artery or vein, your artery in your heart, to get a stent, or do you think it's unrelated?
Doc, can we have a couple of definitions? Thrombosis?
Yeah, we're going to need a couple of things. Thrombosis just means blood clot.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think we're mixing up arteries and veins here.
Okay.
It would be extremely unusual to have a blood clot in the internal jugular vein. The only way that would happen is if you were instrumented. Instrumented or trauma, meaning instrumented, meaning you had a line, an IV line put in there, pacemaker.
I did, yeah.
Then you can get a clot there, okay? Now, will that clot move over to the arterial side, for example, a clot in your heart that could lead to a heart attack? The answer is no, unless you have a hole in the heart, which allows the clot to get from one side to the other.
Okay, vein, artery, two different systems.
Two different closed systems. You can have an abnormal connection between the two, but they're two different systems.
One's going south, one's going north?
That's correct.
Yeah.
One's red, one's
like
blue.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you,
Dee.
Thanks
a lot.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, bye.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Ellen in Shelburne Falls. Okay, Ellen, you're on.
Hi. I just would like the doctor to expand on the statement when you said that walking is just as good as running. It seems to me there are lots of differences. Could you expand on that statement?
Sure. If you're getting the time that I asked for, which is 30 minutes a day, three times a week, you're getting your heart rate up, meaning that you got your circulation going. There's no reason to have to beat your legs into submission and hurt your knees and
your back,
and your back and really pound yourself into oblivion. This is particularly germane to people who are getting a little bit older out there. They can't run anymore. You know, a lot of us, the walking wounded, we played sports in high school.
What about uphill walking versus level walking?
Uphill walking is generally going to be a little bit better for you because your heart rate's going to get a little bit higher.
Right.
So in in general, anything that makes your heart rate get up a little bit higher, as long as you tolerate it well and you keep an eye on it, doesn't get too high, is going to be a little bit better for you.
Mm-hmm.
But you can get the same. You can get. My point was, you can get all the benefits of exercise by walking. You don't have to run.
And let me just add, from my own non-medical experience, and I do a lot of walking, is that you can move fast when you're walking.
Correct.
And what you don't want to do, it seems to me, is break into a run, which makes it easier.
Correct. You're absolutely right, Alan.
Yeah. Ellen, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. You know, one of the risks of a program like this is somebody who may have been doing it one way, like, you know, me taking 81 milligram aspirin every day. You hear something, you say, oh, no, the thinking has changed, or I ran every day because I thought running was better than walking.
But if you're doing it and it works for you, I would say continue it.
Sure. Let's go to John in Gloversville, where nobody goes barehanded. Go ahead, John.
Yes. My question for the doctor was, I'm 55 and I'm experiencing a lot of stiffness in my back and in my hands. Usually tends to warm up, throughout the day. What his thoughts are on Celebrex.
Well, first of all, welcome to the club. Welcome to the Arthritis Club. As we get older, we're all going to be in that boat. My feeling on Celebrex and all non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which are the ibuprofens, the naprosins, and things like that, is the same. And that is as follows. None of them are good for you, none in terms of your heart. They all have certain cardiovascular risk associated with them. I recommend to my patients that they take them sparingly, use them when you have to, but don't use them when you don't have to. We all have good days. We all have bad days. All the problems that occur with those drugs have been shown to occur in studies where patients took them every day. And my feeling is, if you give the body a break every now and then, if you allow it to recover from the medications, that will mitigate the risk somewhat. So I don't think Celebrex is particularly any better or worse than any of the other ones in terms of heart risk. It may be a little bit better for your stomach, but certainly not for heart risk.
My friends, go ahead. Sorry.
And what about the alternatives like fish oil and so on?
Fish oil has been studied in fairly large trials now for heart disease prevention, and it's pretty much a no-go at this point.
Doesn't work.
Well, let's think about this for a minute, Alan. It's arrogant of us to think that we can eat a Western diet, go to McDonald's, and take 12 fish oil tablets a day and have the same risk as a bunch of Eskimos or people living in Japan who eat fish all the time. It's just not the same.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. Let's go to Jim and Adams. Okay, Jim and Adams, you're on.
Good afternoon, Dr. Allen and the other doctor. I didn't get the name. I'm just
Dr. O'Day.
Calling in the program just lately here. Listening to a previous caller asking how we can lower our overall inflammation in the body nutritionally. A four-letter word, kelp is the answer. Every day I take powdered kelp with cider vinegar and some apple juice, and it's getting my acidity level, my alkaline level, my blood down to the alkaline state.
I'm going to have to go with, I have not heard that that is particularly helpful one way or the other, but I would look forward to a study.
The worst side effect you're going to have is you're better nutrition from all the minerals in the kelp.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Jim. Appreciate it.
All right.
Yep. All right. Let's go to Chuck in Gilderland. Chuck in Gilderland, you're on.
Afternoon, doctors. 45-year-old male, have a family history of heart disease, have slightly high cholesterol, low HDL. I'm currently on Crestor. I have a zero calcium score. Avid runner and cyclist, probably exercise at least 8 hours a week. I'm wondering if I should be continuing this regimentation with the medication or not.
Now you're getting into tough questions, Chuck. That's a tough one. Do you know what your CRP level is?
I can't say right now. I might
do that. Check your CRP level because you're at relatively low risk because of the low calcium score. That's not no risk, but it's low risk. And if that's your only risk factor is the family history, I'd have to ask you a lot of questions about your family history, how bad it is, and then how low your HDL is to be able to tell you that one way or the other. So I think more knowledge is necessary than I can get on this call into specifics with you. But talk to your doctor about it because the calcium score does put you at a lower risk, but you have to take that in context with everything else.
And the family history thing is so interesting. interesting because your parents may never have stood up.
That's correct. You know, well, family histories can be funny. And you can have a family history. Everybody at the age of 45 drops dead of a heart attack. That's one family history.
Yeah, yeah.
The other is that, you know, at 75, everybody who smoked and didn't take care of themselves all had heart attacks. And then you don't smoke. That's a different story.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay. You talk about, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
You talk about that. My father had a heart attack at 46, had quadruple bypass, had another minor heart attack at 52. Yet my mother's side of the family lived to 102, and she smokes to this day, and she's 75 with no health problems, no medication, nothing.
And it seems like you might be taking after mom.
And she might have lived.
Let's hope so.
And she I certainly hope so for your sake.
And she might live to 150 if she didn't smoke. Thank you very much.
There you go.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's go to Dave in Pittsfield. Dave, go.
Yes. I was shoveling the other day, and I noticed, I think it was that evening or the next day, I was having some slight chest pains around my left breast area. I was wondering if that had to do with muscle from shoveling, or could it be the heart from shoveling?
Doc, tell them about the big cartoon in your office.
I have a cartoon in my office that shows the pearly gates, and St. Peter's is there, and there's like 10 guys lined up with snow shovels. And St. Peter says, when are you guys going to ever learn? And I have that in all my exam rooms. That's the hardest thing you can do on your heart is shoveling snow. It has to do with using your arms, which is harder work than using your legs. And it also has to do with the fact that you're doing it in the cold. In the cold weather, your arteries clamp down anyway. So to answer your question is certainly it could be, Dave, rather, it could be that you're just sore in your muscles from doing shoveling. But especially if it occurred while you were shoveling, I would go get seen by somebody relatively soon.
Okay, there you go, Dave, and thank you. Let's go to Jerry in Albany. Jerry, you're on.
Hi, doctor. 53-year-old male, very bad family history, as in mid-50s, every male pretty much either dropped dead or had a massive coronary. One survived. But I'm in real good shape, and I run, and I'm scheduled for a CTA next week. Just wondering what you thought of that scan and what it tells you, or what the next what the process would be if it was, you know, really bad or really good.
Okay, very quickly then, Doc, the CTA once again is
CTA is a CAT scan of CT angiogram, CAT scan angiogram.
And you are talking to the right guy, Jerry, because Doc is a specialist in this area.
Okay, so okay. I'm assuming, Jerry, that you had a stress test at some point, right?
Yep, they've all been great.
Okay, they've all been great. So what they're doing, the CTA, is just to kind of get an idea of where you're at. The CTA is very much like the angiogram you get when you get a stent or before you have a bypass done. The only difference is it's non-invasive, meaning that we can inject the dye through just a regular old IV vein without having to go into an artery and up into your heart. So the risk is considerably lower. You only have to run the risk of dye exposure, which is relatively minimal. If you are relatively in good shape, like you say you are, the doc should be able to get a very good picture of what your arteries look like. Now, the question becomes is whatever they find. In a patient that doesn't have symptoms and has a negative stress test, unless they find something horrible, like a 95% blockage in the beginning of an artery, the recommendation is going to be to treat it with medicine. A lot of people will knee-jerk go right to a catheterization or an invasive procedure after that. I caution against that.
Okay.
Jerry, thank you. Okay, Gordon in Albany. Gordon, you're on. We're coming around the bend here, Gordon. We've got to keep it short. Go ahead.
Great. Thanks, guys. Excellent show. Just a quick question. I was just wondering if time has worn out the cardioprotective effect of modest amounts of red wine. I know that some time ago there was a lot of study and talk about 4 ounces being wonderful, 6 to 8, maybe even a smidge better. And I just wonder what time has done, and if this
Okay, Gordon, we got it. Red wine, Doc.
It turns out there's nothing special about red wine, alcohol in general. So whether you're drinking red wine, white wine, or a beer, moderate amounts of alcohol, similar to the amounts that he said, are good for you.
And if we're not drinking any like me,
it's not going to really hurt
you're
you.
Killing yourself.
You're not killing yourself. Okay. It's not going to hurt you.
Gordon, thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Let's go to Connie and Troy. Connie and Troy, you're on.
Hi.
Hey.
I have a question. I have a family member that
was diagnosed with a ventricular aneurysm about over a year ago, and they wanted to do surgery, but she refused surgery. And I'm wondering if it's something that ever heals on its own, or if it's a ticking time bomb, or, you know, whatever.
If you're talking about a ventricular aneurysm in the heart, generally they do not heal by themselves, with the exception of what we talked about earlier, and that was the stress cardiomyopathy, or the heart attack brought on by stress. That will heal itself. But if it's due to blocked arteries and a real-life heart attack, then they do not heal themselves. They generally don't rupture either. The problem with them is they lead to heart failure and arrhythmias.
Okay. Connie, I'm so sorry we have to cut you off, but we're going to the next one now. Let's go to Ernie in Pittsfield. Ernie, you're on.
Yeah, quick question for you. I've had a couple of stents placed, and I do the polar plunge. I've had a couple of the doctors say that it's a bad thing. A couple of them say it doesn't make a difference. Just asking your opinion.
If it's really quick like that and you're in and out, it probably is not a bad thing. But remember, anytime you're exposed to cold, your arteries have a tendency to clamp down and constrict. So in general, probably not a good thing. But if you're just dunking in and out, it's probably not going to hurt you.
Hey, Ernie, you know, I'm not the doctor, but I wouldn't do it. Thank you very much.
All righty.
Let's go to Barry and Latham. Barry, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about calcium in the arteries.
Yeah.
I've been reading some studies that indicate that it's possible that taking calcium supplements will cause that buildup in the arteries. Do you have any opinion on that?
Not true. Absolutely no data to support that.
Okay, that's that. All right, let's go. Where are we now? I think I know. Okay. I'm going to read two that have come in over the net. For several years, my mammogram report has mentioned calcification in the aorta. My primary care physician says everyone has some. I'm 76, cholesterol controlled with 10 milligrams of atorvastatin. No cardiac symptoms, but don't get much exercise because of osteoarthritis. Is the above calcification the same bad news that previously mentioned calcium scan would measure?
The short answer is yes, but your doctor is also correct in that once you get to a certain age, everybody has calcification in the aorta. So that in and of itself, if it's a small amount, doesn't mean anything.
Okay. And then comes from Steve. And referring to the blood thinner Coumadin, stated that it prevents stroke, in quotes. But I thought it reduced the incidence of stroke. An important difference. Can he qualify?
Absolutely. Let me qualify that. It does not prevent 100% the incidence of stroke. It does decrease the incidence of stroke. He's right.
Okay. And then we'll go to very quickly to Steve in West Stockbridge. Steve, go.
Hi. I'm a normal 62-year-old male. I do landscaping all summer long, kind of quiet during the winter. My blood pressure's always run like, 120 over 60, those numbers. And I've noticed all of a sudden 6 months ago, it started running like 132 over 80 or 85. And I'm going to have a doctor's appointment in 2 months, but I'm just curious as to what you think might be going on.
The short answer is watch it. It's still normal. So don't get all worked up over it because that'll make it higher. I would take a look at your exercise regimen, your weight, and your salt intake.
Yeah. Okay, Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to, and this will have to be the last one, Lisa in Latham. Lisa, you're on.
Hi, doctor. I was wondering, do you practice in the Capital Region by any chance?
No, ma'am. I practice in the Poughkeepsie area.
Oh, okay. Well, I was wondering, in general then, how there are, rehab programs for people who are, post-bypass surgery? Are there any, such programs if you just have risk factors, but, a solid program per se that would,
Lisa, the last thing I want to do is be rude, but we're almost out of time. Doc, you want to answer?
So real quickly, Lisa, anybody that's running a cardiac rehabilitation program that you mentioned after stents and bypass will also have a wellness program associated with it. And many commercial gyms will also have cardiac wellness programs associated with them as well. So basically, you just got to call around and ask.
That's terrific.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
So much.
Well, we are out of time, and Frankly, we got to everybody. I can't believe it, because there were a lot of people up there. I want to thank Dr. Daniel O'Day for joining us today. Dr. O'Day, you were terrific. Really great. I want to compliment you. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the phones. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/voxpop. Stay tuned now for a news update.